Going Linux, episode 322, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill. Whether you're new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and open source applications and using them to get things done.
If you want, you can send us feedback at our email address at goinglinux@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-904-468-7889.
In today's episode, listener feedback.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, Bill. What's new with you?
Not much. Work, sleep, and work. Yeah, that's pretty much it. But I hear some of us went on a cruise.
Yes, I took a vacation, and that's one of the reasons why this episode is a little bit late. And we'll catch up again, I'm sure, but we'll continue to have our regular number of episodes per month. Just this one might be a little bit late, and maybe the next one as well. But they might we'll see what we can do.
I think they could forgive you for a little bit of that.
I think so. Yeah, okay. So anyway, we've got lots of listener feedback here. Why don't we jump right in?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Well, Harold sent us an email about Wi-Fi. He wrote, I have been a listener for about a year, and I've been a Linux user since I bought my first computer, a Zanbu Mini, in 2006. It is still the best computing experience I have ever had. Since then, I have had a series of desktops and laptops. In the last few years, I have found that I am unable to log in to my local library, and then started using the library in the next town over. It was working up until a month ago. Also, I have had no luck with the Wi-Fi on the train and bus for the past couple of years. So, has the Wi-Fi login changed for these sites, or has Linux, i.e. Network Manager, missing some configuration? I would really appreciate it if you could help me. This has been a problem on several laptops and distributions. Harold. Well, thanks, Harold.
Sounds like they just changed the passwords.
Yeah, maybe they changed the passwords. Maybe they changed the SSID, the actual ID that you connect to. It really depends on what kind of error message, Harold, that you're getting. And I really don't have enough information on your email to be able to tell. I did exchange a little bit more with Harold, and Harold wrote back saying, I just rode the Amtrak train to New York City and did something different when I logged into Amtrak's Wi-Fi. I opened the Chrome browser, and it opened a login page. I did a Google search of the problem, and someone suggested that it was a problem with Firefox. Now, I don't know if this will work with the library, but I will try when I get home. I was an Ubuntu user until 16.04 when I switched to Ubuntu GNOME, which, after the sad news from Ubuntu this past week, seems like I jumped the ship before it sank. I will be interested in how Ubuntu proper themes its new GNOME desktop. The Wi-Fi works fine at home and here in Queens at my sister's place and in the local coffee houses where they give you the password and you log in just as you would at home, but not at places like Starbucks, where you need a web page to accept and log in. I think this is the case because on previous trips by bus, I could find the bus station Wi-Fi and it looked as if I was logged in, but no web pages would load. My wife opened her MacBook and Safari opened and presented her with a bus station login screen and she accepted it and was in. Thank you for your help, and I will keep you updated about the library. Okay, so that additional explanation, Harold, kind of makes sense. If you had already connected to the library Wi-Fi and they subsequent to that had added in this login page, maybe all you really have to do is attempt to go to a page like google.com or something like that. And usually these third-party login pages will jump in when you try to access any sort of web page. So give that a try, but ask at the library. See if they can explain what has changed. That's probably the best bet. You know, ask the librarian. They may or may not know, but the librarian may be the person that manages the Wi-Fi, or they may have a service that does it. Either way, they should be able to tell you what's going on.
Yeah, I think a lot of businesses are going to where you connect and then you have to accept the terms and conditions. So,
right, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, our next email come from Greg, who wrote to tell us about the password safe and Dropbox. He went, "Dear Larry and Bill," by the way, you got top billing this time.
Yeah.
"Like many Linux users, I migrated my computers incrementally from Windows to Linux. I realized early on that I needed a password manager and settled on PasswordSafe," and he gives the link in the show notes, "which is written for Windows. I soon discovered that it also ran fine with Wine and Linux. Yay! As my collection of network computers here in the house grew, I, of course, wanted the same password data on all of them. Dropbox to the rescue. By moving the PasswordSafe database, PasswordSafe.PSSafe3, into my Dropbox directory, I now have my synchronized passwords at my fingertips, no matter what machine I am using. I no longer run Windows on any of my machines, but PasswordSafe works so well for me that I see no reason to change. I thought other sliders might appreciate the versatility of this combination during their migration to Linux. 73 Greg, WA8FJK." That was pretty clever, actually.
Yeah. It sounds like PasswordSafe has a version for... I was going to say it has a version for Linux, but he says he's running it in Linux under Wine.
Yeah.
But hey, as long as it works, what the heck?
Yeah, that's pretty ingenious, because no matter what Linux machine he's using, he's able to use the database because it's stored in the cloud. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm glad I thought of that.
There you go.
All right.
Our next email is from Ambrose, who asked about his Wi-Fi problem. "Bill and Larry, I thought I'd give Bill top billing this time. Oh, so sorry for that joke. I'm writing about a recent problem I'm having, and I thought maybe Yinz guys or the listeners could help me out. Oh, yes, I'm a Yinzer. Do you know what a Yinzer is?
I do not. So.
Okay. I had to look it up, and a Yinzer is from somebody from the Western Pennsylvania area, and it comes from, the root of the word comes from the same origin as the phrase use guys, you know, use.
Oh, guys. Okay.
So Yinz guys, it's kind of that kind of thing. A slang term that's become popular in a regional area of the United States.
I did not know that. Okay. Well, it's the same as in the South when everybody says y'all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, y'all. So you'll hear a lot of Southern people say, "Y'all, come on down." Of course. Okay. Never mind. Let's move right along.
All right. Moving right along. Ambrose continues. "Over the years, I've written several scripts and configuration files. This is sysadmin type stuff for setting up a new installation. I do a lot of installations, and I found if I keep this stuff in the /user/local structure, it's easy to just copy that to a new installation and soft link it into the system partition. So, for example, and this is the operative example, I use an rc.local to load the firewall and some IP sets. The boot expects this to be in /etc/rc.local. But on my system, /etc/rc.local is a link to /user/local/etsy/rc.local. You get the idea. This has worked well so far. It makes the setup of a new install a bit easier. The one problem is that I often have several Linuxes installed, each with their own copy of the /user/local directory. So if I make a change to one of the scripts, it has to be propagated to the other Linuxes and to the backup. This is error-prone and a hassle. I thought it might be easier to put my /user/local on a separate partition. Any Linux I install can then mount that partition at boot time. So there's one copy in common, which eliminates the file sync problem. So I did this and rebooted. Works fine. The partition is mounted in the right place, except my rc.local was not run. The firewall and IP sets were not loaded, and the syslog showed no attempt to run rc.local compatibility. When I switch back, it works. So ownership and permissions are okay. I'm running Zubuntu with systemd as the init system. I don't know much about systemd, but my guess is that at the point of the boot, when the systemd is deciding whether or not it has run an rc.local, not all the partitions have been auto-mounted. So it sees my /etc/rc.local, but at that point, it's a broken link. I don't know if that's true, and I don't know if it's due to systemd or Ubuntu's implementation thereof, but any ideas would be appreciated. Thanks for the podcast, The Spectacular Ambrose. What do you think, Bill?
I don't know. I don't know enough about how systemd works, so...
Yeah. I think systemd may be a bit of a red herring here.
Yeah,
so I wrote back to Ambrose. Yinzer's welcome. I've been to Pittsburgh a couple of times, and I've lived in Western New Jersey several years ago. Nice town. Clever solution to create the link. I suspect you're right, though. The drive isn't mounted at the time the system tries running rc.local. My suggestion is to copy the script into a bash script in your home /bin folder, so a bin folder in your home directory. Then add the script as a startup application. That way it's run only after your drive is mounted and your home partition has been recognized. I don't know whether you have any other creative ideas or not, Bill, but that's the one that I suggested. As I said, I think it's just not mounting that partition before it goes to actually try to read that rc.local file.
I'd be interested to see if that worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our next email come from Billy, and he has a question for us. He says, "Hey, Going Linux. I've only recently discovered your podcast, and I really enjoy it. I've got plenty of listening ahead of me, 320 podcasts." Oh, wow. Oh, okay. That's a lot of podcasts, but I think I was the only one that actually listened from the very beginning, so you'll see it kind of evolve. "I choose to use Linux because it's better for our environment. My laptop is very old and works perfectly with Ubuntu. No need to constantly buy new hardware. No need to throw resources on the landfill. I'm sorry to see Unity go, nevertheless. I understand the rationale. I prefer the older style GNOME Ubuntu, but I kept with Unity because of its consistency. I have a question. Does GNOME require more resources to run than Unity, and how long will it take Ubuntu to get back on track post 18.04 LTS? Once again, well done on the podcast. Kind regards, Billy, Cork, Ireland." Okay. I think I can answer part of this.
Okay.
I would say the GNOME probably takes maybe a little less or just about the same as a Unity. As far as consistency, I would recommend him going with Ubuntu Mate, because it looks just like the old GNOME, and I believe you'll see that it'll probably run a little faster, because a bunch of Monte's projects, they've worked really hard to make sure it runs fast, and actually you'll probably find some of the newer features kind of pleasant. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And since it's now an official flavor of Ubuntu, I think you'll find it very, very consistent. If you do choose to continue with the official GNOME version of Ubuntu, which is going to become the main flagship version of Ubuntu going forward, I think you'll find that they bring it up to speed pretty quickly and make it consistent going forward pretty quickly, probably with the next release, which I guess will be, 1710? It may take them to 1804 to get it to, you know, a stable point, and 1804 is a long-term support release, so that will definitely be their flagship from then on if they don't get it all completed by 1810. It's a bit of work, but as you've noted, they do have an Ubuntu GNOME spin right now, and I'm suspecting that they're just moving that community-supported version into the mainstream for Ubuntu. I don't know whether they're rewriting it from scratch or spinning it off from that or how they're actually implementing it, but they'll have it and they'll have it stable. And I agree that GNOME probably uses less resources than Unity, and certainly Mate uses less than either of those two.
I think that's some solid choices.
I think so too. So let's move on to Bob. Bob wrote back, having written us previously, "Hi Larry, I am flattered. I listened to the answer you gave to my question about mapping trackball keys in episode 320. You said you put a link to some other information in the show notes, but you posted exactly the same link I sent you. Did you have something else in mind? That link was in fact the technique I implemented, and it seems to have no effect at all. This seems like something that should be really easy to do, so I like to put some effort into figuring it out. At the very least, I'll learn things. Is there anything you think I should look into that would help? Possibly what that xbind key src file is for." Well, Bob, I posted your link so that other people would be able to go and see what you had done. And I think I posted some additional information, but maybe I didn't. I'll have to go back and take a look at the show notes for 320 and see if I missed something there. I know it's a bit frustrating when you're trying to get mouse keys to work and you're messing around with key bindings and things like that. And sometimes it's just not possible to get some of these things working. And I hope that's not the case for you. Bill, have you had any experience trying to get trackball keys, buttons, or even mouse buttons, or even keyboard buttons to work that are not recognized by Linux out of the box?
Well, I think I've been fairly lucky on that account. I really haven't had any issues getting it to see my keyboard, for mouse. I've never used a trackball. The closest thing I come to that was when I had my Lenovo. It had the little pointer, but everything seemed to work out of the bag. So I don't know about this. I mean, trackballs, I don't know how it looks at them. You know, because a trackball, you have basically a switch at the top, bottom, and left and right, and the ball is what actually makes it. When you spin it over, it engages that switch, and I know you have to put different variables in and stuff, so I really don't know how it looks at it.
Okay, well, let's turn it over to the experts in our listener community and ask them to provide Bob with a solution, maybe in our Google Plus community chatter group. If you have any suggestions as to alternative ways than the one that Bob delineated in episode 320, please feel free to share those with Bob so he can begin to figure out how to make these extra buttons work on his trackball.
Yep. All right. Ambrose sent us another email. He wrote, "Dear Barry and Lil." Oh, okay. He shouldn't mess with me like that when I hadn't had enough coffee.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. In fact, this is his response back. Look at that.
I had to look at that a minute and like, okay. Your solution works well and was one I hadn't thought of. What I ended up trying was to make the etcrc.local an actual script whose only job is to run my user local / etcrc.local. That seemed to satisfy Ubuntu's RC local compatibility test, so I think we're right. The partition wasn't mounted yet. I'm afraid it ultimately won't matter, though, since I think the RC local compatibility is a temporary solution on Ubuntu systemd. In the future, this may have to be a drop-in systemd service. Since Bill is the well-known ham, I don't know about well-known, but my next question is for him. I have a multimeter which I don't use very often, so I'm trying to use it to test for dead batteries, and I can never remember the symbols. One is a V with a squiggly line like a tilde on a keyboard. The other V is a straight line with three dots below. My guess is the squiggly line is supposed to look for a sine wave, and I should use the other V. Am I right? Is there any limit on the number of questions per listener? Thanks again, the magnificent Ambrose. I responded to Ambrose. I had to actually pull my multimeter out and look at it, and I believe the answer, he had it right. The one with the sine wave underneath the squiggly line, as he likes to call it, is for AC power. And the one with the line and the three dots and the line and another line is for DC. So one's for AC and one's for DC. The good part about it is most modern multimeters, even if you have it on the wrong setting, it won't hurt your meter. Unless you're plugging it into like 440 or something.
Yeah.
But the reply was that it was the line with the three dots. The thing is, I feel kind of stupid, is, you know, you don't use those, you know, I don't use my multimeter like I used to. So I had to actually go look and say, I can't remember myself. But if you repeat that, I'll deny it.
Okay, thanks,
Bob. All right.
All right, Sebastian wrote to say that he needs help.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Larry and Bill. First of all, I want to say that I love your show. I wanted to write to you for a long time, but I never took the time to do it. I've been listening to your podcast for more than a year now. Your show really helped me to get better with Linux. I have a computer that is running Ubuntu Mate 16.04 long-term support on kernel 4.10 on a 120 gigabyte SSD, home partition on a second 1 terabyte hard drive. Primary use for this computer is Plex Media Server. All media are stored on a NAS to 4 terabyte hard drives mounted in /media. So basically all files are on my 1 terabyte local hard drive or on my NAS. I have an external USB drive for backup too. Rsync jobs are programmed every night to be sure I don't lose movies or music. This weekend I left for 3 days, so I put my external drive into my safe in case something happened. When I came back, my Plex server seemed to be offline, so I SSH'd into my box and rebooted. After doing this, I completely lost access to the server, so I had no choice but to put a monitor on it. The screen there was /dev/SDA error. I thought it was my SSD or hard drive at first, but then I thought my backup hard drive was unplugged. I plugged it back in, and the system booted back up. Plex is still not working, though. I SSH'd into it, and when I hit tab, I hit an error. Last time I had this error, it was a disk space issue. I looked at my disk space and there is 0% free space on the SSD. That's SDB1. I tried to see what folder or file was taking up so much space, but I am not able to do that. The best I was able to do is free 1.6 gigabytes of space. I lost my Plex settings doing so, but I managed to reconfigure it back. I need your help to find out what is taking so much space on my drive before thinking on cloning it to a bigger SSD. I need to free some space to be sure my Plex runs well without worrying. Sorry for the long message, but I need to explain everything. Thank you, and continue your great work with your podcast, Sebastian. Well, and Sebastian has provided us a couple of screenshots listing the size of his drives and so on, and you could tell that he has shows up as a 917 gigabyte home drive on SDC. SDA is his /media/backup, and it shows as 1.8 terabytes. His SDB is that 99 gigabyte hard drive with 1.6 gigabytes freed up. It's 99% used, and it's mounted on slash, just plain slash. So it's the root that's mounted. So my thought was maybe he's got, because of all the errors he's had, maybe his hard drive is filling up with an auto-running script that generates a log, and his drive is filled up with log files.
Yeah, I was thinking along those same lines. I was thinking that he might have also pointed by accident his little SSD, and that could be causing a problem. But I think yours might be the answer. He probably has it filled up with logs.
Yeah, that's the most probable explanation. It might be something else going on, but you know, given that your system had a bunch of errors, that it's a Plex server, that it's going to keep trying to access the drive, and you had the drive unplugged for some period of time, it's probably generated a bunch of error messages. And it seems like 100 gigabytes is an awful lot of log files, but I guess it's possible. And if you need some help finding the log files, you might want to display hidden files when you're doing your display of the files. And in the file manager, you press Control H, I think it is, to display hidden files. And then look for anything that ends in .log. That's typically the file extension for log files, right, Bill? Yeah, have you come across log files that end in something else? Or how would you find log files? How would you recommend someone find log files?
I was just thinking about that. Couldn't you do like a wildcard search from the terminal? Like use like a star dot and then whatever the log extension is and see what you pull up?
Yeah, and that'll give you a listing of, you know, what folder they're in and things like that. So that's probably good.
And, yeah, it shouldn't be very difficult. And you could actually see what the size of the log files are or how many you have, because, you know, you might have a log file that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, so you could do an ls-la space star.log and see what you get. That should give you a display of not only the file name, but the size it's taken up as well.
Yeah, so, and you're using a wildcard, so it tells it to look at everything. So that probably is the answer to that.
Yep. So get back to us and let us know, Sebastian. Yeah. I think it's important for us to get to the bottom of this, because it's possible that this could happen to anyone at any time.
Yes, and I'd be interested to see what's eating up his space. Our next email comes from David, who told us that Mate rocks, and we both knew that, but we'll continue. I am on a business trip CPA conference. I opted not to take my heavy computer-issued laptop. Instead, I took my used 200 HP 13-inch HP Stream computer with 2 gigabytes of RAM running Ubuntu Mate. I connected to the work PC using TeamViewer, and I felt like the CPA with the most expensive, most responsive laptop at the accountants conference. This leads me to ask, why would anyone buy a Chromebook when they can have a fully functional computer not prone to viruses by going Linux. I listen to Leo Laporte, who regularly recommends these Chromebooks, and he says they're glorified web appliances. To anyone, I would say buy any PC, get the Windows crap off of it, and install Mate, and you've got best of both worlds. Well, I think the reason that people like the Chromebooks is that there is really, you enter your username, your password, and pretty much everything's just done for you. It takes a little bit more effort to buy a computer, install Linux, set up how you want, install TeamViewer, and so some people just can't or don't want to do that. So that's probably why they're doing it.
Or you could buy a System 76 as a reason or an intraware or something like that, and then you have it all set up for you when you buy it.
Yes, that's a good point. And yes. No, we're not paid to endorse System 76. I wish.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So I think David's on the right track here. We might have made that a Gone Linux story. I don't know whether he's Gone Linux 100%. Thanks for the feedback on that, David. And we agree. Ubuntu Mate rocks for sure. And I struggle to come up with a reason to use my old, it's getting old now, my old Samsung Chromebook, even though its battery seems to last quite a long time. It doesn't do everything that I need it to do. that's just it. So, I agree with you. Why would anybody want a Chromebook when they can have a fully functional computer? Whether they buy one preloaded with Linux or whether they buy something else like your StreamBook and install Linux on it. And I exchanged a couple of emails back and forth with David on this and asked him what model of StreamBook he has, and did he have any driver problems in setting it up? And he said, no, he didn't have any driver problems at all. He says, it's just a standard HP Stream, and everything worked basically out of the box as soon as he got it installed. So great news on that one. HP 13-inch Stream, good choice for installing Linux.
Yeah, sounds like a nice little machine.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. I think that brings us to the end of our emails, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I don't know if you have an application pick or not, Bill, but I'm always on the lookout for cross-platform applications that I can use with my work Mac laptop as well as with Linux. And ran across something called, and it's been around for a long time, I know, but something cross-platform called SimpleNote runs on Linux, runs on Windows, runs on Mac, and it runs on Linux as well. And it is very, very nice. Simple note-taking application. You don't have to sync anything by Dropbox or anything like that because it does the syncing automatically. The downside is it's not anything super secure. Yes, the stuff is encrypted while it's doing its syncing, but the notes that you post are in the cloud and they're not specifically encrypted while in the cloud. So don't put anything insecure on there. Just put, grocery lists and stuff like that, I guess. Most of my notes are cryptic enough as they are, so I don't mind putting them on SimpleNote, and it works quite well. How about you, Bill? Any super duper applications that you've come across?
Not really. I've been playing with my new Samsung Galaxy 8, so I really haven't been looking at anything except having my my nose pushed into my phone, seeing what it can do. So, no.
So what is that? A tiny laptop or something? I mean, what?
Well, apparently, it's new Samsung. I upgrade about once a year, and so I've been looking forward to it. And all I can say is
it's a nice phone.
Yeah, it's really fast. So
yeah.
But I'll see if I can't find a decent application. But I have no excuse. I've just been so busy.
Yeah, well, hey, that's the way it goes. And thanks, Bill.
Thanks for nothing.
Thanks for nothing, Bill. Okay. Next time around, we'll have an application pick, I'm sure. It's usually me that doesn't have the application pick, so I'll let you off the hook here.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Our next episode will be a regular user experience episode. We haven't picked the topic yet, so don't get too excited.
Until then, you can go to our website at goinglinux.com for articles and show notes, as well as links to download and subscribe.
We are the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
If you like, you can participate directly with our friendly and helpful community members by joining the discussion in our Going Linux Podcast Google Plus community.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.